This is Layla Mudin, RD. I see patients every day here at the Hoffman Center. If you require a nutrition consult with me, but live out of town, there's no need to travel to New York City. I have telephone consultations with clients from all over the country. Please visit drhoffman.com for more information. And to set up an appointment, call 212-779-1744. That's 212-779-1744. I look forward to being a collaborator in your healthcare.
Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and a very, very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year to you because, well, we're right upon it. It's the last big week, a big run-up to the holidays. And thank you for taking a break during your busy, frenetic schedule of parties and gift hunting and family and whatever else you're about this holiday season to spend a few minutes listening to health information with us today. It's Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions. Layla Mudin, our Hoffman Center nutritionist, with us today. So, big question posed at the end of part one of today's Q&A with Layla. And
yeah.
We decided to flip it over to part two because it's a pretty, that's a real essay question. So repeat the question, please.
Yeah. Judy writes, Doctor, I love your show and learn a lot. Do you have any suggestions for a 39-year-old female with low energy?
Okay. I think just the way the question was framed suggests that this person is looking for some sort of energy panacea, like, take L-carnitine or take coenzyme Q10 or ubiquinol, and that will pep you up invariably. That's just a good thing to try. It really differs, as you know, from our methodology at the Hoffman Center, wherein if we see a patient who's a 39-year-old female who has low energy, there's no set protocol. We investigate very thoroughly. We take a detailed history. We examine the patient. We look at previous blood tests, and then we run some blood tests of our own. And in fact, I wrote an entire book, which I recommend to this patient, even though it's, a little older book. It's, at least 10 years old. It's called Tired All the Time, How to Regain Your Lost Energy. And it's one of my more popular books. And in it, these pie charts of, like, industrial growth or, you can sort of pie chart anything, your stock portfolio, you can pie chart the racial or national distribution of a country. Well, you can pie chart your fatigue because usually your fatigue doesn't come from just one source. It may be 60% of your fatigue may come from a low thyroid, unbeknownst to you, because conventional doctors may have not investigated it. They say, well, your lumbers look normal, but when we look further, they're not so normal. It may be 20% may come from some mild to moderate depression. 20% may come from an iron deficiency. Another 10% may come from a B12 deficiency. Then there are, blood sugar metabolic reasons for fatigue. There are allergic reasons for fatigue. There's so much going on here that, we really need to probe
deeper.
She needs a workup. But
my first question would be, how much sleep is she getting?
Sure, and that too. That's
you know, people take sleep for granted, and they're drinking coffee all day long just to stay awake.
Yeah.
That's adrenal stress right there.
Right, why go to something esoteric like, mercury toxicity or Lyme disease or something, when it could be a simple thing. And I'll tell you, Layla, what would you say is the most common cause of fatigue in a 39-year-old woman? I'll see if you agree with me. I'll take a shot at it first.
I would think adrenal stress and possibly low thyroid.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go with I'm going to go with a different possibility. I agree with that. Those are very common, but probably the single most common cause of fatigue. Maybe it's sleep deprivation because 39-year-old women are uniformly busy. That's number one.
They're busy. They probably have young children.
Right.
They're in a career. They're taking care of their parents.
But
who needs to sleep?
How about this one? Iron deficiency. Because
women
are menstruating at that age. They may have had a couple of children. They may also have some degree of malabsorption, because it turns out that for many people, eating wheat, for example, impairs their absorption of iron. So they have a hell of a time properly absorbing iron. And some are deliberately on a vegan or vegetarian, quasi-vegan diet, where they're not getting adequate iron. You know, they're told to avoid red meat, and iron deficiency is pretty prevalent in that age group. And you don't actually have to have true anemia to be fatigued. Mm-hmm. There are three levels. One is you do a CBC and you have a low blood count. Okay, that's pretty obvious. Then there's, you don't have a low blood count, but when we check your iron, it's low. And sometimes your iron is normal, but the most sensitive test for iron deficiency is the ferritin test. Yes. And for patients who have fatigue, we want the ferritin not just to be normal, we want it to be mid-range. We want it to be 50, 60, 70, even though they accept, some of the scales say 20 or 22 is okay, but you may not feel well on that.
Right. And I think you need a ferritin. For those people who don't know, ferritin is the storage form of iron in the body. It basically tells you what your reserves are. And I think we need a ferritin of at least 60 or 70 to support thyroid.
Right.
So that might be something. Okay. Iron deficiency would be,
Right. So we could do podcast after podcast on this subject. But without further facts, we're only speculating. And, this is the kind of patient where, if I had, a dozen 39-year-old females with fatigue every week at the Hoffman Center, I'd be very happy, because that's really in our wheelhouse. That's the kind of thing that we can, as nutritionally oriented physicians, as complementary physicians, we can look at in an integrative fashion. And, of course, many of the patients that we see, they've been very well scrutinized from a conventional medical standpoint. They've had the basic tests, and they're probably not missing anything big. That's why we have to probe more deeply to find the hidden cause of the problem.
Yeah.
But I will say, here, just an example of what can happen. One of the worst kind of situations is, we did have a patient, and I think you know her, because we both saw her pretty extensively, who said one of the most daunting things that I could hear in the doctor's chair was, she said she's fatigued. And I said, well, one of my first questions is, how long has it been? Because if we can establish there was a cause or a precipitant of the fatigue, or, say this person says, I've been fatigued ever since I got back from a trip to South America. Well, okay. Well, maybe the person has parasites. You don't necessarily have to die. But the worst thing a person can say is, I've had a lifelong history of fatigue. Oh, boy. Well, maybe that's just constitutional, that there is some, people have different energy levels. But what happened was, we looked at her thyroid. It looked a little low. We gave her thyroid for the first time in her life. This woman is what? I think she's 60 years old.
Yeah.
She just woke up.
She woke up for the first time in years. She said to me, I can't believe how well I feel.
So this is an example of, you shouldn't give up. I think many conventional physicians say, look, what do you expect? You're 65 or you're 55 or, you're going to slow down. Doctors will kind of commiserate with you and say, well, I'm slowing down too, and that's how it is. And it's going to be worse. Well, it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be. I mean, look, we got to be realistic. You can't, sometimes feel wonderful 100% of the time, especially when you're a little older. But we shouldn't give up in our search for the cause.
Yeah. Judy, best of luck. Go get a workup.
Yeah.
Okay, we've got a question from Al. Al says, my doctor's had me on a Dilaudid pump implant for 10 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
For what?
He doesn't say. The only way that I can have a bowel movement since then was to use a series of supplements, including Senna, which is a strong stimulant.
Right.
It's actually laxative. Unfortunately, this has caused severe distension and cramping. What can I use as a safe alternative on a long-term basis to continue to have normal bowel movements.
Okay, so let's explain what's going on here.
There
is, when you take opiates, and opiates the original opiate was opium, but then there was morphine, and then there was heroin, and then there are what are called synthetic opiates, which Dilaudid is an example of. Oxycodone is an example of a synthetic opiate. And they're great for pain, but the side effect is constipation. Okay?
Yeah.
And
slows everything down, yeah.
Right. And so what they have... And this is... It's very tough to overcome that. So, you know, we can go through all the things that help constipation if you want to, Layla. I mean, you know, we talk about... I just want to say there's a new medication that actually targets this. And the medication is called Movantik. And with the accent on move, M-O-V, because it is specifically targeted to opioid-induced constipation. And the way it works, kind of ingenious, it blocks the activation of opioid receptors in the intestinal tract.
Oh, that's brilliant.
While not blocking the activation of opioid receptors in the brain. So that you get the opioid benefits in terms of pain reduction. And oh, by the way, somebody who's been on a Dilaudid pump for 10 years, they're addicted. They're addicted. They're going to go through crashing withdrawal. They can't stop. You know, they just to function, they have to be on it. But so this new drug, I don't have direct experience with it, but he should ask his doctor about it because it just came out. And
wow. And what's it called again?
It's called Movantik. Movantik.
Movantik.
And it's what it is, it's a mu opioid receptor drug. In other words, there's certain types of opioid receptors in the gut that are associated with constipation.
Mm-hmm.
And it blocks those.
Wow. Wow. And for those that don't know, what Al has been taking, Senna is a laxative. It's an herbal laxative. It's in a lot of teas. Be careful, everybody. It's in a lot of, quote, dieters teas. Things like Swiss Kris, Ballerina tea. I've heard various names.
Creates dependency.
For these teas.
Creates dependency. Yeah. And then you eventually habituate, and then, you know, your bowel gets completely paralyzed. And, you know, you
it's
get
like
a late...
taking X-Lax every day. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So once you're that constipated for that long, sometimes it's really bad because just like any muscle, the muscles of defecation become lazy and weak.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a problem.
So Al would probably benefit more from this new drug than,
possibly,
taking lots of magnesium citrate, which is a stool softener, or Flowey, which is a prebiotic kiwi extract that helps to maintain bowel regularity.
Those are for ordinary patients. But a patient who's on a Dilaudid pump, that's an extreme example of a medication-induced constipation.
All right.
Okay. Boy, we got the tough questions here, don't we?
Yeah, really. Al, best of luck to you. Look it up, Movantik.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see. We've got a question from Michael. Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, first, I do want to state that you both have a great show, and I always look forward to many of your informative podcasts and articles, as well as recommending your show to many of my friends. Thank you, Michael. Anyways, can you please explain the mechanism, in brief, how insulin causes scarring of the lining of the blood vessels? I didn't just realize until recently that the scarring from insulin actually occurs, and now I kind of understand why cholesterol rises, particularly I would think the LDL fraction when people have metabolic syndrome or insulin resistance. Well, the very short answer is oxidized LDL, for one thing. A high insulin level is accompanied by a high blood sugar level, and this can oxidize LDL, which may then begin to cause obstruction.
Yeah, yes? I think I've seen explanations of that specific question, but my eyes glaze over almost when I see the complex web of events that occurs when insulin is high. You know, as you know, first of all, high levels of insulin trigger fat retention. Fat retention promotes a cytokine situation in the body, which is pro-inflammatory. That's a sort of simple way to explain. And then the inflammation can be pervasive. It can be, you know, we know that obese individuals are more prone to many types of inflammation, inflammatory joint problems. You know, sometimes we think that when, you know, you are having knee arthritis because you're overweight, it's just because you're carrying extra weight. It's a physical thing that the joints are grinding because you're carrying 50 extra pounds. But actually, that may not be the case because young, healthy GIs who are carrying, you know, 85-pound packs in the field don't necessarily get knee problems. So there's a... And why is it, in that case, that you may have finger arthritis? You know, you have stiff fingers in the morning when you're obese. You're not walking on your knuckles. So it's a body-wide pro-inflammatory condition, and that affects the interior of the arteries. So yes, LDL cholesterol is one of the mechanisms because insulin, excess insulin distorts the lipid profile. It will promote higher levels of bad LDL and lower levels of HDL, and especially higher levels of triglycerides.
Yes.
So that's that whole metabolic syndrome.
Yeah.
So, you know, there, and then there's probably a whole cascade of events on a molecular level that... that ensue.
There's another way that insulin, because it can promote high blood pressure by causing the body to retain more sodium, that high blood pressure can eventually cause hardening of the arteries, and that will cause more scarring and problems.
Yes. So that's why that it's not a simple question to ask. There's a pervasive negative effect of high levels of insulin.
Right. Michael, thank you for that question.
In addition to simply, you know, you have more insulin and you crave more sugar. You know, you get that vicious cycle of eating and eating and boom, you know.
Yes.
And then, hey, guess what? Another mechanism is when your hemoglobin A1C starts to climb in response to the high insulin. You know, it goes from optimal, which is maybe 5.3 or 5.4, to 5.9, 6.1, 6.3. Hemoglobin A1C measures the glycosylation of a protein in the body, which is hemoglobin. And glycosylation is one of the ways in which the delicate tissue in the endothelium is damaged. It literally, the proteins in the wall of the artery are attacked by sugar molecules. The sugar binds to them and causes glycosylation. So what? We came up with, what, 5, 6, 7 different mechanisms?
Yeah.
Right? So,
and that glycosylation, another way of saying that is rust.
Right. Right. Or
rust.
You know, or you know, it's also caramelization, literally. Caramelization is, you know when you want to put an ice crust on a steak or barbecue, you put some blackstrap molasses in there or some some sugar in the barbecue thing, and that will glycosylate with the protein, and it'll form a an advanced glycation end product, which is probably not great to eat a lot of either.
I was just thinking of creme brulee.
Yeah, well, I love creme brulee, but you take a blowtorch to it. It's basically sugar interacting with the protein. And it's kind of like you're taking taking a blowtorch to the interior of your arteries.
Yeah. All right. Thank you for that very thought-provoking question, Michael.
Yeah.
All right. We've got a question from Richard. Dear Dr. Hoffman, are there better times of day to take supplements? I know such vitamins as A, C, D, etc. should be taken with meals, but what about things like magnesium and CoQ10 and fish oil? Are there better benefits when taken at certain times of day, such as before bedtime? Thank you. I actually wrote about this in one of our newsletters recently. I know most people who are taking their supplements with their at mealtimes, that's really the right way to take it, with the exception of certain things like maybe some amino acids or probiotics. But we've had some people report, and myself included, you know, when I take magnesium during the day, I get a little, you know, drowsy, a little sedated. So we would recommend that you take your magnesium at dinner time or even at bedtime. Mm-hmm. That might be a way to take it. And alternatively,
by the way, I take my magnesium in the morning. I don't think it knocks me out at all. But you know, some people are so sensitive to the effects of these things that you have to individualize it.
Right, right. I, for instance, have to take magnesium in the evening.
You're sensitive.
I've tried taking it at lunchtime here, and I'm like, oh no, I'm just sleepy now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. Alternatively, things like CoQ10, maybe B12, things like that, people may find energizing.
Mm-hmm.
So they may find that it's better, they tolerate it better taking it earlier in the day, say at breakfast and lunch,
mm-hmm.
rather than dinner. If they are sensitive to it, it may keep them awake.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So we've had some of that, yeah. But, there are optimal ways to take your supplements depending on your reaction. Sure.
How about from the standpoint of absorption? It has been said that you absorb calcium best when you take it at night. And mm-hmm. I think the rationale for that is a lot of the work that gets done to build bone occurs while you sleep. At least that's the theory anyway.
Our repair processes,
So, however, there's also some evidence that calcium is best absorbed with food, that mm-hmm. it seems to, rather than interfering with calcium absorption, it's better absorbed with food.
Yes.
There's also go ahead.
No, I think dinner time is the best time to take calcium.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, for those people or women taking strontium, we let them know to take that at bedtime if they're taking strontium.
Right.
But at least 2 hours away from calcium, so that could kind of work out.
There's also evidence for a threshold absorption of certain things. So if you say, look, mm-hmm. I'm going to take my 5 grams of vitamin C with breakfast, you may only absorb a gram of it. And so if you really want to maintain high levels through the day, well, you may have to take it 4 times a day. It's better to take say you've taken 4 grams, it's better to take it 1 gram 4 times a day than 4 grams once a day. And I think that effect occurs a little bit with calcium too. So it may be a good idea to take, if you're aggressively trying to, by the way, I think calcium's overblown. Most people don't need to take as much as once was thought. But if you're trying to build bone, you may want to take a dose or two with meals during the day and then take one final dose near bedtime, mm-hmm. unless you're taking strontium, in which case you don't want to take it together.
Right, right, right.
However, I don't want to overwhelm people with rules, because I think it's more advantageous to just take your supplements than to really sweat it out and say, well, this has to be taken away from meals, so I can't, I didn't eat, so I can't take this. And I see some patients getting really tied up in knots about the rules for taking supplements. And so my suggestion to supplement takers is, don't get farklempt. That's a fancy, that's a Yiddish word, which means don't get bent out of shape about it. Just do it. And if you want to do the refinements, that's fine. I mean, if you can do so comfortably, great. Just another thing to mention is that fat-soluble nutrients generally get absorbed better with a little bit of fat. So not just, you know, we know A, D, E, K, these are the fat-soluble mm-hmm. nutrients, but also some of the things like mixed carotenoids, lycopene, mm-hmm. lutein, mm-hmm. Omega-3 fatty acids. These are generally absorbed best, even coenzyme Q10, since it's fat-soluble, are best absorbed with a little bit of fat in the meal as a vehicle to bring it through the digestive tract and to carry it into the circulation.
Yeah. So get rid of that no-cal salad dressing, everybody.
Oh, yeah.
It's not doing you a bit of good. And it's full of junky ingredients anyway.
Emulsifiers.
So good quality extra virgin olive oil.
Synthetic ingredients. Yeah, horrible stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, well, that's all the time we have for today's special pre-holiday edition of Intelligent. You want to sing a Christmas carol or anything like that? No.
I'd love to wish everybody a Merry Christmas.
Okay. Well, I will echo that sentiment. And yeah. We'll be back. We'll be back next week. You know, holidays, kind of things kind of slow down. So maybe you know, this will afford you an opportunity to catch up on your listening. We've got some great podcasts. And my article this week in the Intelligent Medicine Newsletter points you in the direction of our top 10 podcasts of 2015. So if you've missed them, please catch up on them, because by listening to them, you can facilitate your encyclopedic knowledge of this field. We've got lots of astute listeners, and we're going to keep doing our best in 2016 to enhance your nutritional IQ. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Thanks very much, Layla, for joining us.
Thank you, Dr. Hoffman.
And a very happy holiday to you. This is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.